That means that farms that reduce methane can be part of a climate solution. And that is a very different way of dealing with the issue overall and moving our farmers from being a problem to being part of a solution.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Best Mix's industry-specific software supports feed and pet food producers in their daily challenges. Focus on your core job and let Best Mix do the rest.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast brought to you by WiseNex. I am Carlos Campabadal, outreach specialist in feed manufacturing at the IGP Institute of Kansas State University, dedicated to bring you the latest insights and discussions in the feed science industry. Please get ready today to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. So today, it is a great pleasure to introduce you to our guest today, Dr. Frank Midlerner, who is a professor at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Midlerner, it's a pleasure to have you here and here in our Feed Science podcast. And if you can just pretty much just start so our audience can get to know who you are, can tell you a little bit about your career, because I was reading a little bit about it on the on your CV, and in my case, it is a very interesting. So welcome.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. My name is Frank Midlerner, and I grew up in Germany, lived there for 27 years, did my master's in agriculture engineering at the University of Leipzig, then moved to Texas, to Texas Tech University, where I did my PhD. And after about 5 years in Texas, I moved to Davis, California, where I continued with a professorship in animal science as an air quality specialist. So I study the environmental impact of livestock and ways to reduce those impacts. Last but not least, I'm also the director of a sustainability center at UC Davis called the CLEAR Center. And here we do both research and communications around sustainability issues in animal agriculture.
Well, and that's great. I was reading a little bit about your institute, and that for me, for my background, the feed science and the feed manufacturing industry, sustainability is a very important thing. So pretty much some of the things that I think we should cover today in our episode is if you could tell us a little bit how, from your perspective, your opinion, being all these years in the United States and see how pretty much the air quality effect has evolved in the livestock industry in terms of how we control emissions, how on the animal welfare, and how we have become more sustainable for the last two decades whatsoever.
So when I did my PhD several decades ago, sustainability was a curse word. Okay? If you use that word in animal agriculture or in agriculture in general, people thought you were some extremist, some activist. Okay, I always disagreed, because I think sustainability is not just a very important concept. It is an essential concept, because it is what keeps agriculture afloat. If you're not sustainable in the way that you treat your animals, the way you house your animals, the way you deal with the environment, the way you deal with your workers, you just think about that, attracting and retaining a qualified workforce. If you're not sustainable with your finances, then you're not sustainable. You won't stay in business. It's that simple. And so I feel that it is really the hallmark of animal agriculture to attempt to be the most sustainable you can be. And I have seen huge improvements in animal welfare, huge improvements in reducing impacts on air, water, and climate, improvements in dealing with workforces. You know, unfortunately, I have seen little improvements on the finance side. Our farmers are still strained financially, and consumers are not really paying the amount of money that's needed to allow our farming community to live a life that really would allow them to sustain themselves just by the farming income.
No, perfect. And for our audience, please like us, give us a thumb up there, and if you for this episode. But going back to the topic, I agree with you 100%. You know, it's sometimes, and I laugh when you said that people, when you started, sustainability was a curse word, because you might still see a little bit of that, but I do believe it has changed quite a lot. I see that sustainability is many things, like you mentioned, and the finances is something that definitely I didn't think about it, but it is, they do deserve the specific amount of earnings in that sense. So in terms of the environmental perspective, can you tell us a little bit more about the work that you have done related to the air quality linked to this sustainability?
So a couple of decades ago, my main focus was on particles, on particulate matter. That's a fancy word for dust. And here in particular, dust emissions from feedlots, from beef cattle feedlots. If you've been around beef feedlots, you might have seen that particularly in the evening, there can be a significant dust plume leaving a feedlot. And that's very typical. And those things can be a real nuisance. It's pretty much pulverized manure that, when kicked up by animals' hoof action, leaves the facility and can extend for 10 miles or so.
And neighbors
complain about it, not just about the dust factor, but also the odor issue around that. So I studied that for quite a while. Then looked at other criteria pollutants such as ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, and so on. But over the last few years, another topic has bubbled up to the top, and by far that is the most important one in animal agriculture and the greatest Achilles heel in animal agriculture as well, and that's greenhouse gases. And here in particular, the issue of methane and nitrous oxide. Animal agriculture is a major source for methane, and methane is a potent greenhouse gas. It's almost 30 times more potent in trapping heat from the sun than CO2 is, carbon dioxide. And the main source of methane is what we call enteric emissions, and that's what the animals belch out, as well as the animal manure. And here we do a lot of research into finding out feed formulations that minimize the issue, or feed additives that suppress those microbes that produce methane. We also look into breeding, whether breeding of low methane producing animals can make a difference. We are looking at manure interventions, and we are finding that there are many different tools that can be filled into the toolbox of the farmer, depending upon what he or she is most comfortable with, to reduce methane substantially. And here's why that's important. In contrast to other greenhouse gases, methane is short-lived. Okay, all the others are long-lived, but methane is short-lived, and that is because there is another molecule in the air that kills methane, that destroys it. If we, in addition to the natural destruction of methane, reduce it through feed additives, through breeding, through manure treatment, and so on, then we can replenish less methane than is naturally destroyed. And that means the methane now goes down, and with it, the warming goes down. And that means that farms that reduce methane can be part of a climate solution. And that is a very different way of dealing with the issue overall and moving our farmers from being a problem to being part of a solution.
So you switch the angle the other way, and that's, of course, that's fantastic, and that's what research is for. And I think this type of work is very important all around the world, not only here in the United States. Being said that, can you detail a little bit when you mentioned that non-methane animals, can go a little bit more in detail for our audience to, and for myself too, to understand that a little bit more in the specifically?
So what is really good news is that methane is a heritable trait. The mother cow passes it on to her daughter. And there are animals that are naturally higher methane producing than others. And there are now genomic tests. You can take a snip out of the ear and test whether a given animal is a high or low methane producing animal. And then you can take those animals that are low methane producing animals for breeding and not use the high methane producing animals. What's interesting about this is that this methane trait is not linked to performance. So it's not the case that a low methane producing animals would produce less milk or have fewer components in the milk. but all other variables held constant, a low methane producing animal can be selected, and lead, if you do this herd wise, can lead to 30% lower methane emissions from your dairy herd.
30, that's a lot. And will this low methane producing animals will be also linked to, you said it comes genetically, but is that linked also with specific breeds on the, let's say on a dairy cow and a beef cattle? Let's say I have a beef cattle Hereford or a do Angus, is within the whole breed itself?
So for now, this work has been done for dairy cows and not for beef animals. The reason why there's a difference is because we have much more ways of sampling dairy animals because we milk them two or three times a day. And there are milk traits that are correlated to enteric methane. And that is how these tests were developed on the dairy side. For the beef side, I have talked to numerous of the breeding associations about the need to develop an EPD, so a predictive parameter for enteric methane. And I know that they are now working on this. Okay, for the big breeds, the Angus, the Hereford, and other associations, we need an EPD that stands for expected progeny differences, an EPD predictor for enteric methane so that we can not just select animals based on things such as ribeye area and marbling and scrotal circumference, but also based on methane. That is a very interesting approach because you do it once and it has a permanent impact. You don't have to do something day in, day out. You do it once, and once your herd is changed, boom, that topic is gone.
Wow, that's... I'll call that high quality research, high tech, you know, because it is important. And I live here in Kansas, and as you might know, Kansas is a beef cattle producing state. Not dairy, not that much, but still, the impact will be fantastic for all this region in the Midwest overall and in the world.
And you know, one of the reasons why this is important for you is because on the beef side, the greatest emitter within the value chain is the mama cow, the cow-calf operation.
Ah, okay.
And because the animals roam around freely and you don't have daily access to them, you are limited with respect to what you can do to reduce emissions. But breeding is one of those. Okay, breeding is one of those. Another one is, in the future, there will likely be a vaccine for methane.
Oh, wow.
So that could also be an interesting approach where you vaccinate animals once or twice in a year and then you don't have to deal with that topic anymore. And the reason why that might matter to producers is because if you can get carbon credits for something like this, be paid for it, and show that you have reduced emissions, why wouldn't you?
That's right. That's very, very important. And for our audience, please, if you have any questions, please write them there in our comment section, and we'll be sure to get them to meet Dr. Mitt Lerner to answer later. But going back to the topic, I think this is something very interesting and that's definitely very important for the environment, sustainability, and many things. Can you comment a little bit? I know you're doing your work there at UC Davis and you have your institute, but how's the rest of the world doing? You know, there's countries that produce a lot of dairy products in Europe, New Zealand, for example, and others, but how's their approach in this same matter of methane and all what they're doing for compared to what we do here?
There are a couple of countries that really stick out. One of them is New Zealand. You mentioned it. Another one is Ireland. Another one is Uruguay. These countries have a very significant interest in this topic because the livestock industry plays such a big role to their respective
economies.
You can imagine in New Zealand, let's say, livestock emissions make up half of their carbon footprint as a country. Same is true in Ireland and in Uruguay. So they need to fix this. They need to figure out solutions for their respective countries and fix it. And they are working hard on it. Other countries don't really care much. So it's a mixed bag out there. I can tell you this, 4 or 5 years ago, nobody in, let's say, Latin America would have paid much attention on this topic. This is very different now. This last year, or the last 12 months, I've visited 26 countries throughout the world. Most of the countries in Latin America were amongst those. And the reason why there's such an interest in this topic now is because they're under the gun from their customers and clients. So let's say a McDonald's or Burger King will no longer buy your beef if you don't show that you have made market improvements over the last 10, 20 years in and around sustainability. You have to not just show that you're doing something, you have to document that you did and how much it has done, how much it has, what it has resulted in. And so all of a sudden in countries where these topics didn't really matter much in the past, they are hugely important now. We see this topic is certainly not going away. It has been very big here in California. It's spreading throughout the country, the United States. It's already huge in Europe. We are always following behind Europe on environmental sustainability issues here in the United States. But the first to adopt is California, and then it spreads from here throughout the rest of the country. And then, believe it or not, it hops into Latin America. So there's always a chronological sequence of where and when these sustainability topics become big. Starts in Europe, spreads there, goes to California, then throughout the rest of the United States, then Latin America, and then 5 to 10 years later, Asia. It's always like that. It never fails.
And I come from Latin America. I'm originally from Costa Rica, and there's some important dairy production. So I'm very happy that hopefully there are, people are following more there, what you just mentioned. And it is very interesting. I had the opportunity to work from the sustainability more into the processors or U.S. soybeans and other commodities. And it's kind of like the same. The customers are demanding, and you see that. And at the end of the day, people think about it. The perception is always complications, but at the end of the day, we're doing something to make the world better, and we have to also feed the world. So this combination is a little bit more very important overall. And of course, our audience out there, if you learn something today, please share the video on that. As I mentioned, Frank, a lot of our audience is from Latin America, so I'm pretty sure they're very happy to hear all of this. So following this topic a little bit, what do you think are the next trends overall in terms of sustainability related to air quality? Maybe some of the research work that your institute is doing, so maybe the audience can see. I know they have heard a lot of top-notch things going on. I've been taking even notes myself, but I think the audience will be very happy to hear them.
So the whole issue around greenhouse gases is not going away. Okay, so if you haven't put much thought into methane and nitrous oxide, you should, because sooner or later you'll be hit with it. If you're in agriculture, and whether that's animal or plant agriculture, these topics will affect you at some point. And when you hear plant agriculture, you might say, well, what? My grain doesn't belch, which is true, but you are fertilizing your grains and whatever else you grow out there on the fields. And when you fertilize with nitrogen fertilizers, whether these are synthetic fertilizers or animal manure, some of that nitrogen will convert into a greenhouse gas called nitrous oxide. And nitrous oxide is much more potent than even methane. So this topic of greenhouse gases is not going away. Take it seriously and look up what you can do to position yourself to first find out how big of an issue it is for your farm or ranch or operation, and what the best tools are that you can use in order to mitigate. The other topic, I just mentioned that I oftentimes see Europe as being a first adopter on sustainability topics. The big topic in Europe right now is what's called reactive nitrogen. What is reactive nitrogen? So everybody uses that term, but most people don't know what it means. Nitrogen is much more complex than carbon, such as methane. How is it more complicated? Well, just imagine the protein that you feed, let's say, to a cow or to a pig or so. That protein is only partly retained in the animal's body and makes it into meat or milk and so on. The majority of that nitrogen contained in the protein that you feed to these animals is excreted in the form of urine, urea, okay, urine urea or urea in the urine. And that urea, once it hits the ground, can change into various forms of nitrogen. Some forms affect water quality, some forms affect air quality, and some forms affect the climate. Let me explain. You've all heard of nitrates and nitrites. These are groundwater pollutants. Okay, once they are applied to the ground as fertilizer, they are either gobbled up by the plants, because that's the preferred nitrogen source for plants to take on as fertilizer, or if there are no crops and it rains, they leach straight into the groundwater. And there you have nitrate issues, and that's a big, big topic in many parts of the world, nitrate. So that's a groundwater pollutant that can result from, let's say, overfeeding of protein. Then the same urea can also become another pollutant like ammonia, which is an air pollutant. And ammonia can make its way into producing particles called particulate matter 2.5, ammonium nitrate. It can also, that same nitrogen in the urea, can also become nitrous oxide, the greenhouse gas I just talked about. So, and you might ask, well, how can I explain that to someone, that a urea nitrogen molecule can make its way into all these different forms of nitrogen, affecting either air or water or climate? That is explained by the pathways, the microbial and other pathways the nitrogen undergoes. You can actually influence which path the nitrogen goes, whether it affects water quality, air quality, climate, or nothing at all. And most important for this outcome of which effect the nitrogen has, is how and when you apply it to your crops. If you apply nitrogen at agronomic rates to your crops, meaning at rates that are ideal for the growth of your crops when the crops need it, then the nitrogen will not affect air, water, or climate, but it will grow your crops. But if you apply that nitrogen at times when you don't have crop growth, then it will have environmental consequences. And they are on top of the attention in Europe right now. And the same thing will happen in the Americas and in Asia in the years to come. Pay attention to your nitrogen, not just to your methane and to other issues, but pay attention to your nitrogen.
Well, and that also, besides the environmental impact, that not putting it in the right time, that means your plant might not grow, not have the yield. So we go into that sustainability from the financial perspective too. So timing, science, you know, appropriate application tools, putting my ag engineer hat there, are very important overall, and it's part of having a sustainable world overall.
For sure. And if I may add one more point.
Yes, please.
The protein that you feed to your animals is the most expensive ingredient. You don't want to overfeed protein. You want to feed the right amount and not too much. Unfortunately, that is what's happening right now, that many nutritionists, in fear of underfeeding protein, are indeed overfeeding protein. And let's just give you one example. I just finished a study where I fed beef cattle various levels of protein to find out how that affects reactive nitrogen emissions. Let's just assume for a second that 13% of protein fed to beef cattle were ideal. Let's just assume that for a second. And let's assume you're not feeding 13, but you're feeding 14%, 1% more. Then that 1% additional protein that the animal doesn't need will lead to 10% additional nitrogen emissions. If you feed 3% additional protein in the diet, 17 instead of 13%, you will have 30% additional nitrogen emissions as a result.
So it goes 10% higher. Wow, that's amplified. It's quite a lot.
So for every 1% that you overfeed protein, you have 10% additional nitrogen emissions. And that is very significant. You do not want to do this because it's expensive and it has a significant environmental outcome.
That's right. And I, my background is feed operations, but you do see a lot of, especially in the formulation and the nutrition to, like you said, overcompensate protein, not to have the to get to the right levels. And there's an operation perspective too. I know what some people do it, but you know, talking to our my colleagues on the pet food side of things, that sometimes a lot of them say, hey, you know, we over give our dogs or cats protein on their feed, and then eventually it will go into their urine. And, you know, and a lot of them, of course, there's many issues because of that too. I mean, not as the scale of animal production, but it's very important to keep that in mind. So no, this is great information. And, from that sense, and, just to kind of like, as we come into the end of our program, but I think this is great information. Can you detail us a little bit some of the overall outcomes and future work of your institute? And so our audience can go and reach out and look and be more interested, since you mentioned also that you do a lot of work of research and communications on it.
Half of the CLIA Center that I'm directing is specialized in conducting research on feed emissions, on animal emissions, on manure emissions, and ways to reducing those emissions. We also do work around optimizing animal welfare. Sometimes we do work around exposure of workers on farms to pollutants and how to minimize that.
Yes, that's very.
So that research is only good if we take it out into the real world. Research that we don't communicate is not very useful. Unfortunately, most of my colleagues are doing just that. They're doing research, they publish it in a peer-reviewed paper, and then they pat themselves on the shoulder for a job grade done. And of course, we are doing that too, but we are not stopping there. But we are taking that information and we are breaking it down in ways people who need to know it can understand. And this is really critically important. You know, my father passed away 5 years ago. And before he passed away, he said a sentence to me that I'll never forget. It sounds trivial, but it is really meaningful to me. He said to me, Frank, do good things and talk about them.
That's a good message.
And what he meant by that is that the work that we do has to be communicated, not so that people pat you on the shoulders, but so that this work really has an impact in the real world. And if there's one thing that people in agriculture are chronically bad at, it's communication. It's telling our story. It's informing the public why we do what we do. And let's not forget, we are a critical system portion of any society, okay? We are as important to a society as the food sector, as the health sector is. We're as important as doctors and nurses because we are the ones producing the food everybody puts into their mouths every day. But for some reason, while doctors and nurses are highly regarded, farmers are not. And we have to ask ourselves, why not? One of the reasons is the lack of communication, and that has to change. And I, for my side, have decided to make that change. So the CLIA Center at UC Davis, clia.ucdavis.edu, is a resource that I hope you check out. You will find dozens of explainers on topics you might have heard about but never really understood. For example, what's soil carbon sequestration? Or how do cows affect the climate? What's real, what's not real? You will find blogs, you will find YouTube videos, and so on. You will see responses of my center to some of the media reporting that's out there that's oftentimes very largely discussed, widely discussed, broadly discussed, but not accurate. And you will see how we are correcting some of the narrative that is maybe well-intended, but not well-informed.
I agree with that phrase. That's very important. Well-intended, but not well-informed.
It's time for our famous three. With its advanced industry-specific capabilities, Best Mix software empowers nutritionalists and formulators to optimize material allocation, manage recipes, and ensure data confidence for informed decision-making. By providing a comprehensive solution that integrates real-time data and strategic planning tools, BestMix enables you to do the job efficiently and precisely. Focus on your core job and let BestMix do the rest.
This is great information. As we wrap up, any other resource that you would recommend our audience to learn more about this, like a book or a website or something specifically? It could be even an online course, somebody that wants to deepen their knowledge in all this topic.
I would say, just to make it simple, if you were to go to this webpage I just cited, clear.ucdavis.edu, you will find so many references there. Depending upon what the angle is that you are interested in, I would have to give a different answer. But depending on what your interest is, you can go there and then branch out into the direction that you are interested in, whether that's animal manure or enteric emissions, or whether it's crop emissions or mitigation, you know, any of those topics we are dealing with. And if you have specific questions, come and contact us. We will reply. We are also on the road a lot. I already told you in this last year alone, I visited 26 different countries. And the reason is that these topics are hot. These topics are not going away. If there are people from universities listening to this, I can tell you when I was hired here at UC Davis 22 years ago, people said, you know, Frank is right now in a hot topic area, but in 5 years, nobody will care about this. I tell you, they were so wrong. This topic has become only one thing, hot, hotter and hottest. And it has been sizzling. And that's not always a good thing, okay? I have to tell you that too. Because when you investigate this kind of stuff and when you communicate it, then there will be people who don't like that because they have an aversion toward animal agriculture. If you step into the sphere, you can get burned. But if you don't step into the sphere, well, then our entire sector gets burned, and I don't think we deserve that.
No, that's a very good message, and we really appreciate it because, as you mentioned, there's a lot of people against animal agriculture, and because of all this that we've been talking, and I think that's very important for us in the ag sector to understand and have good information, to be well-informed, and as you said, communication is the key, and in the farm sector, we really don't do a good job. And that's part of my job here too, so I completely understand. So with that, as we are wrapping up, one last comment. In your opinion, any professional, your background is in the academic and research forming professionals, what advice would you give somebody seeking to work in our field of overall sustainability, ag production, what to look for in terms of that?
The most important advice I can give is not to stick your head in the sand.
Okay.
Try not to follow the notion of all of this is some kind of a liberal agenda that has nothing to do with the real world. We don't have an impact on climate. We don't affect the environment. We know what we are doing. Leave us alone. These things will no longer resonate. Okay. If they have ever resonated, they no longer resonate. Society expects the farming sector to do their part, to do their share, to optimize our environment, to optimize animal welfare, and so on. Don't stick your head in the sand, but first of all, understand that this is your subject to deal with. This is your legacy that's at stake. Don't let people who have the agenda to destroy your legacy succeed. It is in your best interest to optimize the welfare of the animals that you have control over. It is in your best interest to optimize the soils you have control over, to optimize the environmental quality that you have control over, to optimize your finances, to optimize the people who work with you and their livelihoods. And so, and it is in your best interest to not make this your best kept secret, but to be open about it. Brag with it. I mean, I don't mean brag in the bragging sense of being obnoxious about it, but go out and say, look, what you're concerned with is our livelihood, and we are very interested in optimizing these issues ourselves. And here's what we do. Don't be quiet about it. Don't be private about it. I know it's in your nature, but stop.
Great. No, this is, thanks. Great piece of advice. And overall, we really appreciate you joining us today in the Feed Science Podcast by Wisenetics. So for our audience, please, again, thumbs up, share your video, comment if you have any questions. I think this is a great topic that could be further detailed as we go along. And with that, this concludes another episode of the Feed Science Podcast presented by Wisenetics. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on future events. And if you enjoyed, again, today's episode, please leave us a review. Your feedback is very valuable to us. Until next time, this is Carlos Campabadal from the Feed Science Podcast signing off.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.